You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. In New York City, youth activists gathered last Saturday in Harlem, New York, to oppose what they call a war on people of color abroad and at home. Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer for WPFW in Washington, has this report.
More than 2,000 youth and their teachers gathered in Spanish Harlem in New York City to oppose what they denounced as a local and global war on black and brown people. Victims of an increased recruitment drive in their public schools, they rallied for hours under the cold rain. In chants, spoken word, and discussions, their message is clear. We need to stop the war on the poor and the people of color in this country before we go get involved abroad. Fred Nguyen from WBIX.org, the Refugees and Exiles Radio Network in New York City, brings us some of their voices and opinions, starting with Silice Fraser from the Action for Community Empowerment in Harlem.
We cannot fight a war in another country until the government's war against its own people is won. They're working to find Osama bin Laden, but they can't find out who pumps drugs in our communities. We cannot stop the war in another country until we declare that the war America has declared on its own people is complete. Do you feel me? Let me give you some statistics about this war. 7 out of 10 New York City youth drop out of a system that's only designed to educate them until the 8th grade. 5 out of 10 New York City youth will end up going in the penitentiary system. 3 out of 5 New York City youth will be on some type of public assistance for their single parent child. 51% of Harlem is made up of youth population, but less than 50 of us are employed. They say we can't get an education, we're supposed to work, but they don't provide the jobs and we end up in a prison. America has declared a war against its own people, and until that war is eradicated, we cannot eradicate hate, violence, or their lust for oil in another country. America, citizens, youth, we gotta let Bush know, I am not your cattle in Texas. I will not fight your battles for oil. I am living revolution. Hear me loud, hear us now. Free your minds.
1, 2, 3, 4, we gonna stop this racist war. 5, 6, 7, 8, stop the killing, stop the hate.
Estamos aquí hoy como parte de la comunidad de la ciudad de Nueva York que viene a decir junto a la voz de la mayoría de esta nación, no queremos guerra. What we demand is George Bush to stop his plan of making the war in Iraq. What we want is peace. There's no reason why this country will be investing $10 billion every day if they start the war and they don't want to increase to give a fair salary to the transit worker union in New York City. What we demand is money for schools, money for housing, money for jobs, no for work.
What do we want?
Peace.
When do we want it?
No.
What do we want?
Peace.
When do we want it?
No.
Imprisonment I suffer in this country, in this capitalist society, as a young black Latina woman. I have been imprisoned in a world built with hatred. It's not due to my deeds, my right doings, or sins. These prison walls weren't heard, and so my soul weeps. My tears fall into my only property, my pen and pad, my ancestors' legacy. That's all I have. My mission is clear, the survival of humankind. I will arrest the all inmates who are standing by my side. We must rise. Stand and shout. We want jobs instead of war. We want schools instead of war. We want life, not war. Peace to y'all.
We're here representing the Universal Zulu Nation and the hip-hop community, which is now worldwide. Peoples of all creeds, races, and backgrounds. And here in New York, in particular, in this country, we're here to say we do not hate ourselves. We are not suicidal, and we will not go to war to help the same people who are daily oppressing us and keeping us down. We will not help lace the boot that is on our throats. We will not aid the Texicos and the Bushes and the people keeping us in projects and welfares and on the streets. We will not help the people keeping us hustling. We're going to fight the system that's keeping us down, and we will not go and die for them.
You have a no war for oil.
I volunteer at a political bookstore on the weekends. I'm a New York City high school student. I've been to protests, especially the walkout 3 weeks ago. And I try to educate myself as much as I can, reading alternative media either online or getting free newspapers or political newspapers in general. So I think the worst thing in the world is to be, you know, denied knowledge and to be ignorant. And I think it's a responsibility for all of us, especially the younger generation, because us as teenagers are so underestimated so many times, and it just proves so many people wrong. We're going to take an active part in how we're going to live in this country. We do care about people in other countries. It's also changing the face of how other countries see this country, because since we're the future, we're going to be the next generation, and what other generations have done in the past to harm other countries, it might not mean as much if we're trying to rectify those wrongs.
Stop the killing! Stop the hate!
I work for the Dominican Women's Development Center. This is a non-profit organization. And I brought my students today. They're taking citizenship classes. And I'm teaching them what war does to our money. I'd rather pay more for oil than pay for life.
What's your name?
Rachel.
Rachel, is this your first demonstration?
Yes, it is. I live in this neighborhood, and I feel like so many of our young people would be sent to fight in this war, and I don't think it's right. I have a friend that teaches high school up here, and she said that they're recruiting all the time in Washington Heights now, and I don't think that's right.
They're coming into the classrooms, ROTC, and promoting students joining the Army or the Armed Forces in general. There's also Junior ROTC organized at the school. I'm a graduate student at City College. I teach at a high school as well, and I don't feel that it's right to come in and make presentations when there's such a volatile political situation going on, and a lot of my students aren't informed enough to make decisions.
Have you asked your students what they think of it? Have you engaged a dialogue?
To some extent, but not very much, because it's a very controversial topic. I know that a lot of students might see the Army or the Armed Forces as an opportunity to go somewhere, to leave the neighborhood, and I don't know how much right I have to influence them one way or the other. I could lose my job for pushing my own political agenda. I don't know that I think that's right either. My students are also 15 and 16, and the boys in particular tend to be very hawkish about this issue because they're all about fighting. And I think that's typical of someone that age.
This interwar rally was organized by the Uptown Youth for Peace and Justice and the Young Communist League in New York City. For Peace Watch, I'm Reem Katkhuda on behalf of WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C.
Among the countries the United States has approached seeking help for its proposed war on Iraq is Turkey, which shares a southern border with Iraq. The Turkish military cooperation was a topic of discussion at a forum held in Istanbul over the weekend. Among the speakers was Tariq Ali, a longtime editor of the New Left Review and author of over a dozen books on history and politics. According to the Pakistani-born novelist and playwright, Turkey's cooperation is a given.
The Turkish military will go along with the war because they've gone along with everything the Americans have wanted so far since the Cold War began. It's very interesting as a footnote that the two countries in this part of the world who are totally behind the United States are both former empires themselves, Britain and Turkey. Maybe they appreciate what it is to be an empire, and they know, because they have accepted tributes for so long from their own vassals, that they know what it is to be a vassal, so they fit into the position very quickly, on their knees before the United States. This is what the Turkish military have been doing. And when they carried out massive acts of repression against the Kurdish people, against the left in this country, leading to mass killings, brutal tortures in the 80s, none of our big human rights warriors protested in the New York Times or the Washington Post or these countries. They didn't care because their enemies were being taken care of. So this is where Turkish public opinion, which is beginning to assert itself, becomes important now. You have to do something, friends. And this is where you can learn some lessons from the Israeli opposition. What our friend from Israel didn't mention, but which for me is one of the most moving acts of opposition in the modern world, is that 500 reservists including people to the level of colonels, have said that they will not defend the state of Israel outside the 67 frontiers, the occupied lands. They will not defend it. Could we have, do you think, 500 Turkish reservists to say we will not go and fight your filthy war in Iraq for your own oil interests and for your own oil aims? Will they do it? I doubt it. And I'm addressing a symposium organized by a confederation of trades unions. You too, my friends, I address our trade union brothers and sisters, have real power. You work, you oil the machinery of these countries. Consider something. Consider talking to your members. Consider saying to them, if we are taken into a war without the people of Turkey being asked whether they are for or against this war, we will withdraw our labor to try and stop this war. I'll tell you something which is happening in Britain even now. There's a strike by... There is, at the present moment in Britain, a big strike taking place. You know, people felt in the New World Order strikes too were dead, no one was going to go out on strike, but the Fire Brigades Union, the people who put out fires, went on strike because they are paid very badly. And the leadership of this strike are young workers who have grown up over the last 10 years. They're in their 20s and 30s. They're a generation which has not been defeated. Their fathers were defeated by Margaret Thatcher. But this new generation of trade unionists feel that they have not been defeated and they have everything to fight for. And they're fighting. And this new Labour government is trying to defeat them, attacking them, slandering them. But you know, what I notice from these young working class leaders is their courage and their intelligence. They are saying on big television stations, when they are asked, they think the government says there's no money to pay us. And yet the Chancellor of the Exchequer has just declared that £1 billion has been put aside to fight the war in Iraq. What sort of a country are we living in? So they have been marching now in big numbers in demonstrations for Palestine and against the war on Iraq. And that is something which shows that if it can happen in a country like Britain, where internationalist consciousness is not something which distinguished that working class historically, it can begin to happen elsewhere. And I have noticed, and I say this when I go to the Arab world, I think every single day on your screens you have known what the result of sanctions in Iraq has been. So, you know, people say to me, what would you do in Iraq? I said I would strengthen the people of Iraq so that they develop the strength and courage to topple their own dictators. That's always the best way to do it. It sometimes takes... It can take a long time, but it took 30 years for the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia to be defeated. No one from the left said, why doesn't China intervene in 1965 when they massacred 1 million communists? When the Chilean dictatorship overthrew democracy and kicked out and killed people in 73, no one said, why doesn't Cuba intervene? You have to accept the defeat and then try and work to undermine it. And it can take 20, 30 years, but sooner or later it will happen. The problem with American-style interventions, one of the many problems, is that they make the situation worse. They do not improve it. You can see that in Bosnia, you can see that in Kosovo, and you will see it in Iraq when it happens.
As Tariq Ali spoke in Istanbul, Iraqi opponents of Saddam Hussein were meeting in London in a forum organized by the Bush administration. At the table were hardline Islamic fundamentalists, two rival Kurdish armies, the heir to the Iraqi throne, and the right-wing Iraqi National Congress. Ali spoke with Peace Watch correspondent Aaron Glantz.
Right now, there's a meeting of various so-called dissident groups opposing Saddam Hussein that are meeting together to plan out a post-Saddam government in Iraq. What do you think of this group of people, and what do you think of the meeting?
I think this is a meeting organized by the intelligence agencies of the United States, backed by the British intelligence services. Most of these people are totally corrupt, discredited people who have very little support inside Iraq itself. That's the first thing to understand. When a newspaper like the Financial Times can publish a full page denouncing Ahmad Chalabi, the so-called leader backed by the Pentagon, then you realize that there are big problems. This is a guy who is totally corrupt, who left Iraq when the monarchy was overthrown because his family worked with the monarchy in Iraq. He's a deeply reactionary guy. He's a deeply corrupt businessman whose businesses have collapsed in different parts of the world. He's a fraudster who's been making money now because he's been on the payroll of the American intelligence network. So if this is the guy they want to put in power in Iraq, they will have to keep a very large American force there to protect him, like they're protecting Hamid Karzai in Kabul. The notion that this is anything to do with democracy in Iraq is a sick joke.
The group of people that's meeting is incredibly diverse. You not only have the Iraqi National Congress, you have some militant Islamic forces, you have people who want to bring back the king, all kinds of people. What does that mean?
Basically, it means that the whole thing is a joke, that the real decisions will be made by the occupying force, i.e. the United States. They have already declared that one thing which is not on the agenda is democracy. So if you rule out and exclude people choosing their own government for themselves, then you have to play around with all these people. They will probably set up a weak national coalition after they have occupied Iraq, set up a loose federation, trying to make that a substitute for democracy, but I think they will run into problems very soon.
When you say that you think that they'll run into problems very soon, what do you mean by that? And do you foresee a large occupying army in Iraq after a war?
Well, I think once you topple Saddam Hussein, which they're planning to do, the one thing that people will expect is democracy, which Saddam Hussein denied them. If you then deny them that democracy and give them something which pretends to be a democracy but in reality isn't, people will be angry and they will respond in different ways. As for how they will react exactly, it's difficult to see. The only armed groups in the country are the Kurdish organizations. The bulk of the country's population are Shiites, 75%, maybe more. So if these people are denied the right to rule the country, I think the United States is going to be in trouble. And I think they will need a large occupying force to run that country unless they do a deal with Saddam's army. They tell, you know, having destroyed the Saddam and his family, there is a wing in the American State Department which believes that they should do a deal with the post-Saddam Iraqi army and see if they can run the country on their behalf. They always prefer to do things like that, but this may not be possible, especially if a bulk of that army has been destroyed in a war and 250,000 civilian lives have been taken.
I mean, the government of the United States clearly sees the Afghan war as a great success, not only in the defeat of the Taliban, but also in the setting up of this new government that's there now.
The Afghan war never took place. The Taliban didn't fight. They basically packed their bags, shaved their beards, and went back into Pakistan. There was less fighting in Afghanistan from October to December 2001 than there had been in the previous 25 years. Everyone is waiting, keeping their powder dry, biding their time, thinking that they might... They're waiting for the Americans to go, and then the real fun will begin. As for the Karzai government in Kabul, Karzai doesn't allow a single Afghan to be part of his personal bodyguard. That speaks volumes. And if they set up a similar government in Iraq, it's not going to work. Iraq is a very different country from Afghanistan. And even if they do deals, I think it will last for a short time, but sooner or later there will be rebellions, and then they'll have to deal with them. I also think that they might get much more resistance in Iraq than they got in Afghanistan. Saddam is not going to make the mistake he made in the Gulf War, which is leave his army stranded in the middle of the desert so that the American army could go on a turkey shoot and kill them from the air. I think he'll keep his armies in the cities so that they will fight in the cities, and in order to take them, they'll have to destroy the cities. And if they destroy the cities, there'll be very heavy civilian casualties.
Noted novelist and playwright Tariq Ali speaking with Peace Watch reporter Aaron Glantz in Istanbul. In London over the weekend, more than 300 Iraqi opposition leaders met to strategize for a possible post-Saddam Iraq. Reuters News Service referred to the meeting as a show of unity and little else. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Ahmad Chalabi, head of the Iraq National Congress, said that after the fall of Saddam Hussein, U.S. oil companies would be at risk. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Spoke with Dilip Hero, author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm and War Without End, about the meeting this weekend in London.
When it comes to this kind of a thing, the puppet master is what counts, not the puppets. The whole thing is funded by the U.S. Everybody knows that. And I will give you a quote, which is in today's New York Times. A highly placed American observer at this particular conference in London said, in quote, more than 80% of these guys will have no place in post-Saddam government. His words. I would like to add to that 80% another 19%. And make it 99%. Essentially, this is the PR job. Mr. Ahmad Chalabi left Iraq when he was exactly 13 years old, 1-3, and he has not been to what is proper Iraq. For some years, he was in Kurdistan, and after the attempt by them to overthrow Saddam from Kurdistan failed, he is persona non grata in Kurdistan itself. How much he knows about Iraq, I probably know much better than him, because I have spent some time in Iraq about 2 years ago. And now, about the oil, it's very simple. In fact, I have done a long piece, the op-ed for The Nation, which is going out today on their website. And I go into this. Let's just remember this. Mr. Chavez, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Of course, when he was campaigning, he said all these contracts in Venezuela are so much against Venezuelan interests that when I get to power, I'm going to throw them out. So has he thrown them out? You know, so it's very easily said that, you know, whatever is done, you know, because if I, as a puppet of the USA, come to power, then all these things will be thrown away. It is simply not done, you know, and the Saddam's government has given out contracts to 28 countries, 30 contracts, all the way from Russia, France, China, India, Vietnam, Italy, Spain. But if you take the big picture, 30 contracts, which are worth hundreds of billions of dollars, anybody think that all those oil companies, all the way from Russia, China, India, and Vietnam and Spain and Italy are just going to go to sleep so that Mr. Chalabi can keep his word that he has given? I mean, it's a joke.
We're talking to Dilip Hero. He is author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm and also another book called War Without End, The Rise of Islamist Terrorism and Global Response. Your book, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, goes extensively into Iraq's history and also the U.S. relationship with it. Right now, you talk about, in a recent piece you did for The Guardian, you talk about the most common used description of Saddam Hussein when they want to demonize him is talking about the man who gassed his own people.
Sure, of course. I mean, this happened in 1988, March 1988, and it had to do with Saddam's government trying to seize back the liberated area of the Kurdish region, which had been liberated by the Kurdish parties working in alliance with the Iraqi enemy of Iran when Iran and Iraq were at war. When he used those particular weapons in March 1988, Mr. Schultz, George Schultz, he was the U.S. Secretary of State, and his British counterpart, Jeffrey Howe, they said, yes, there is evidence that chemical weapons have been used, but the evidence is not, in quote, conclusive. Ah, that means the U.S. and the U.K. knew he was using chemical weapons. Saddam started using chemical weapons in October 1983. And do you know what? a gentleman who is doing a book on U.S. and Iraq relations has discovered through his research that President Reagan's ambassador to the Middle East, Donald Rumsfeld, went with a letter from Mr. Reagan, had a meeting with Saddam Hussein, who was notorious even in those days for eating babies for breakfast, and had a meeting with Tariq Aziz, and they discussed oil. They did not talk about chemical weapons which had been used just 2 months before. And Saddam used these chemical weapons very extensively in 1988 to retake the areas he had lost to Iran. It's widely known. In FAO, in February 1986, there was a story done by Patrick Tyler of the New York Times, 18th of August of this year, in which he said, when Iraqi troops retook their FAO peninsula from the Iranians, they had used chemical weapons, and there were two officers from the Defense Intelligence Agency. They went there after 2 days and found some parts of that particular operation had been sealed off because chemical weapons had been used. So the Americans and the British have known about the chemical weapons being used widely during the Iran-Iraq war, then against the Kurds, and that happened March 1988. Amnesia for 14 years, and now, oh my God, this guy is using gas against his own people. But, you know, these chemical things that come in, how did Saddam get it? He got them from Germany. The German firms were selling chemical equipment for, in quote, pesticide. And this was done through the Turkish intermediaries. So is any, and if, you know, this 12,000-page report that has been given by Saddam, you know what's being done right now? It's being cleaned up. Because in that report, Saddam has given the complete list of the European and the American company to supply these things out of which he made WMD. And this is all going
weapons
to be censored.
Wait, let's talk about that.
The point is very simple. When something is being done for American interest, the American interest can go as far as the tip of my nose. And out of that grows something 10 years, 20 years later on, which is much bigger. You can go back to, you said, my book, War Without End. Mr. Bin Laden, he was in bed with the CIA. Everybody knows that. So they solved the immediate problem, got the Soviets out of Afghanistan in 1989. And in year 2001, we know what happened. So you see, this is one of the criticisms or analysis that I give in all my books in the Middle East. Please, if you're trying to solve a problem, don't get so hung up to solve it immediately and in the process create much bigger problems which will mature 10, 15 years from now. And that is exactly if Mr. Bush goes to go in for this strike against Iraq, that's what's going to happen. If Bush goes into Iraq, he will create more problems than will be solved. And at the same time, we have to remember all these Shalabi types, they are just puppets. They have no use. And America has its own game plan, and they are not going to put all this money and all the ground forces and suffering that will come to the American people and their military establishment, and then have these jokers, you know, failed bankers to come around and run the country for them. Absolutely not.
Dilip Hero, author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm and War Without End, a historical perspective on Iraq. He was speaking this morning on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks today also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.